válido de lunes a jueves. You
the Safari Park. You're killing me, Larry.
Larry, fucking Larry.
Larry from That Larry Show.
For men with balls.
Take off your pants.
Larry, get into bed now.
Larry.
Larry. Larry.
Come on, Larry. Larry.
There is no American holiday that's more emblematic of home than Thanksgiving. You sort of need to be Christian to be into Christmas. You don't have to be, but it's tough to extract all the goodies from Christmas if you're not. Thanksgiving has no specific religious underpinnings. Those pilgrims were mostly Calvinists, and the Indians that helped them make it through the first winter had another belief system entirely. So in terms of universality and inclusivity, Thanksgiving is top shelf. But still, leftist globalist creeps are doing their damnedest to marginalize it, same as they do to every pillar of American culture, from the Star-Spangled Banner to the flag to the Constitution. Like a story in some online magazine that's appropriately named Babble. It says that, quote,
Thanksgiving, believe it or not, a holiday for showing gratitude is not uniquely American.
Really? That statement carries a certain subtext, doesn't it? Inferring that your Thanksgiving isn't all that special. The story further belittles the holiday with this.
You're likely familiar with the very embellished legend.
Hey now. They just downgraded a big chunk of extremely well-documented American history, and American pride, I might add, to mythology, a legend, an embellished legend. This Thanksgiving hit piece goes on to name other places on the globe that allegedly have similar celebrations. In point of fact, the only similarity is that some people are thankful for something and have some kind of celebration sometimes because there was a successful harvest. Big fucking deal. There's no comparison. None. Perhaps Babel's source was the go-to source for most leftist bullshit, Wikipedia. When you look there, it's practically a cut-and-paste job. How many of our 330 million citizens have even a foggy notion of who the pilgrims were and how utterly amazing they were? All most people know is that they wore big hats and had buckles on their shoes. The reasons pilgrims came to America are also the pillars of this podcast. 1. They took no shit. 2. Every one of them was a confirmed LUTFA. That's leave us the fuck alone. They came to America to get away from ASTCOs. That's assholes seeking to control others. In their time, the 15th century, commies did not exist. Neither did Democrats or Republicans, which is why those words and those parties are just fabricated current names for the elemental primordial makeup of people. LUTFAs, who are good, and ASTCOs, who are assholes. The pilgrim LUTFAs were relentlessly hassled and persecuted in England because they refused to participate in the state-approved religion. That sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Pope Fauci and Emperor Joey demanding we accept their sacraments? In less than 3 years, America went from take a knee to take a needle or starve. So the pilgrims voted with their feet, same as millions of Americans are now fleeing oppressive states like New York and California. Pilgrims were not wealthy people. They had to cut a deal with some investors. The company staked them to the voyage and the supplies to found a settlement, but as payment, the pilgrims had to kick back a steady stream of whatever they could eke out of their new home, fish, meat, furs, and so on. That deal would last 7 long years, after which the pilgrims could divide what they had built among themselves. That was hardly a sweetheart deal. But that's capitalism. Believe it or not, the Mayflower ship was rented. It took them 66 days to cross the Atlantic, and when they arrived here, it was brutal from jump. Winters were a lot tougher than those in Western Europe. 102 people stepped off that ship in December of 1620. A year later, only 52 were still alive. A 49% survival rate. Wow, that's even worse than the China virus. Their angel investors did not send them a single stimulus check, not even a bag of limes to help with the scurvy. And the company crew soon sailed the Mayflower back to Europe. The now marooned settlers made friends with some very cool Indians who helped them get through that first winter. And by the autumn harvest, they'd managed to not only keep it together, they had a big surplus of everything, especially turkey. How did that happen? With balls and a work ethic, that's how. So they threw a party, a feast, and they invited 90 of their closest friends, who were all Wampanoag Indians. Hey, that sounds like diversity, doesn't it? Real diversity, born of people teaming up out of friendship and gratitude. Not because they were forced to by social engineers. And that party was not a leisurely afternoon dinner like some of us are about to enjoy. It was a 3-day blowout. It must have been fantastic. George Washington declared the last Thursday, November, as Thanksgiving Day. Much later, Abe Lincoln, presiding over a nation tearing itself apart, well, he thought it might be a good idea to make Thanksgiving an official holiday, something that everyone could celebrate and get behind. And so he did. Imagine that. Making a new national holiday that's for everyone, not specific groups and communities or ethnicities or sexualities. What a concept. So quaint. So obsolete. The story of the pilgrims and the first American Thanksgiving is much, much more than a harvest festival. Maybe next time the leftist and catastrophically ignorant writer at Babbel does a story, he'll do a little more research than Wikifuckingpedia. There. Now that we've saved America, let's get down to the pleasure of Thanksgiving and the treasure that it is. It used to be a big, big deal. The gateway to the Christmas season. It was such a big deal that the Amazon of its day, Macy's, the world's largest department store, figured it was a great reason to throw a parade in the middle of Manhattan. A parade with hundreds of cute girls in drum majorette costumes, spinning batons, and high-stepping up Fifth Avenue as their knees turned red in the cold. Between the marching bands were those enormous helium balloons of Superman and Popeye, with dozens of dudes hanging onto ropes as they walked, hoping the wind wouldn't swoop them into the clouds. It was must-see TV for every kid, and you had to keep your face stuck to the RCA until the very end, or else you'd miss Santa Claus. Dad would wait to see Santa Claus on the float as well. I always wondered about that until I grew up and watched with my kids. Santa was flanked by pointy adult females wearing elf costumes that were sure to hold Santa's attention and piss off Mrs. Claus. There are no mysteries. And those Macy's guys were smart. By the Matt Lauer and Savannah Guthrie era, the parade had been ruined. It was no longer about kids and Thanksgiving. It was about monetization. Moronic Broadway shows would stop the parade and take center stage so they could lip-sync to the signature number. Last time I saw this, the big show was kinky boots. Yeah, five-year-olds are really eager to watch kinky boots, I'm sure. Every second of the parade was some kind of plug for some product. It's been destroyed by greed and politicking scumbags with their sick, kid-corrupting agenda. Shitty parades aside, late fall can be pretty cold, gray, and gloomy. But Thanksgiving, it's like the fun guy that starts a party when you need it most. Live wire guys, ones that kick off dice games in a trench on a battlefield, or tell really funny jokes to somebody being wheeled into an operating room. The guy who magically materializes a flask full of good bourbon when you're ice fishing. That's what Thanksgiving is. It's almost like John the Baptist, the dude that says, "Hang in there, folks. Good times are just around the corner, so why wait? Gorge now. Eat, drink, and be merry." There's even an element to Thanksgiving that actually trumps Christmas, and that is no gifts. That alleviates so much pressure and hassles and disappointment. The only obligation is to show up with an appetite and enjoy. And so we do. And what do we want out of Thanksgiving? It means many different things to different people. At some Thanksgivings, dinner is almost an afterthought. It's all about the football games. And that's okay for football fans. There were a couple where I was a long, long way from family and had dinner with the Rolling Stones. No, not Mick and Keith. The Rolling Stones was what a friend called her Thanksgiving gatherings. Her family was in South America. So she would put up a fantastic dinner and invite friends to her penthouse apartment in Manhattan. We were all in the same boat, separated from family by great distance. But we all got along famously, eating and drinking and laughing. After dinner, we sat on the terrace, gazing at the glittering Manhattan skyline, sipping Grand Marnier and telling stories. They were special experiences. Though far from family, none of us felt lonesome. There were many Thanksgivings at home, with Mom and Dad and my older brother. Every one of those was wonderful. Not a bad one in the bunch. There were a couple spent with my Uncle John up in the Catskill Mountains in his cozy house that he built himself. That home had it all. A roaring fireplace, comfy kitchen, and the coolest room you could imagine. A den filled with leather-bound books, decoy ducks, and a shotgun, and a 30-odd six and a rack and a wall. It was Field and Stream Valhalla, and for a kid from the city, oh, another dimension. Beside the perfect trappings of country life, his home was awash in the most important Thanksgiving elements, love and goodwill. It was a place you never wanted to leave, and it was his and his wonderful wife's presence that made it that way. Long ago, I watched a documentary about an incredibly wealthy woman giving a tour of one of her many mansions. After dozens of bedrooms, bathrooms, several kitchens, and servants' quarters, she turned to the camera and said with some sadness, "It's not home, but it's much." When I started my own family one Thanksgiving, we were up in San Francisco at an old and beautiful restaurant called Jules Castle. It clung to the side of a mountain and had a walk-around balcony. Of course, being San Francisco, it was windy and wet. My first daughter was just about 2 years old. I carried her around that deck, and she stared at the magnificent Golden Gate, half shrouded in fog, her face glistening in the mist. It was pure magic. When we sat down to eat, she loaded up on breadsticks and other appetizers and fell asleep before the main course came. The waiter brought over a second chair and fixed her a makeshift bed. She slept as my wife and I ate like lords. Hard to top that one. What's your idea of the perfect Thanksgiving? I feel as if I've already had a bunch of perfect Thanksgivings, but sometimes, I daydream and art direct the elusive Currier and Ives Thanksgiving experience. It's out there, in some gorgeous rural paradise, a place I've only seen in drawings and paintings. It's not New York or L.A. or the desert or the shore. There's a rambling colonial-style home with a big wooden porch and lit candles in the windows and smoke curling up from the chimney. Outside is a pasture and split-rail fences with a few horses and cows and sheep dotting the hills right to the horizon. I sit in a glider on that porch, smoking a Sherlock Holmes pipe I've never owned but always wanted. The bowl contains smoldering Borkum Riff. There's a good-sized slug of Lagavulin, neat, and a glass on the table beside that glider. There is no wind. It's chilly, but not freezing. Moose lies asleep in my lap. The late afternoon sky is heavy with gray satin clouds, and they have that slight sulfurous tint to them, which usually portends snowfall. Inside, my wife and kids are mashing sweet potatoes, basting the turkey, doing all the heavy lifting for a feast. I hear them laugh and talk as they work, and I think to myself, it doesn't get any better than this. They'll enlist my help for the final and simplest chore, carving the bird. It's a lot easier since my cousin gave me that electric knife a few years back. He passed not long after. I ease my head back on the glider's cushion and close my eyes. Moose's breath is warm on my hand and my mind wanders. Until I hear the purr of a V8 motor and tires crunching the gravel road leading up to this house. A house I think I've seen in those woodcut renderings, but have never actually visited until this Thanksgiving. As the car draws near, I open my eyes to see a Ford Crown Vic from the mid-80s. It looks sort of familiar. It stops just off the porch. And out steps my Uncle John and Aunt Stell, looking like they did when I was much younger. They barely exit the Ford when a vintage Impala pulls up right behind it. I know that car, and I know the occupants. Mom and Dad. And so continues the arrivals of more retro cars and retro people. People I loved, who made so many Thanksgivings so extraordinary for me. My grandfather, father and mother-in-law, aunts and uncles, a few cousins, and some wonderful friends who were all, every one, gone too soon. There are hugs and kisses and smiles and handshakes and backslaps. A light snow begins to fall, ushering the crowd inside the house. A magnificent, long, candlelit table is set to perfection. Everyone takes a seat. Somehow, there are just the right number of chairs. I look around the room as a silence falls over it. My wife asks me to say grace. I'm speechless. Wherever you find yourself tomorrow, whether surrounded by people you love or solamente, consuming a kingly meal or a bucket of KFC, I wish you a Thanksgiving of peace and health and love and abundance. And thank you for spending this time with me. If you like what you just heard, stop by thatlarryshow.com. There's plenty more there. Someone once called it an audio banquet. I'll see you next Wednesday. And until that time, happy Thanksgiving.